I guess I'm going to be talking about decentralized control and the motor system, and hopefully I don't make it too controlsy. I wanted to edit the talk a lot more than I did, but yeah, hopefully this should work out. Okay, so before I get started, I'd like to kind of get back to sort of the beginnings of modern control and sort of how it got, you know, how it all got started, and really how what shaped the shape of control. And so back in sort of the beginning of the digital revolution, that's really when modern control started taking off. So we had these digital computers that we could use to implement control laws, and our theory was really shaped by having these computers at our disposal. And the thing that was really nice about digital computers is that they're very easy to conceptualize and think about. We kind of think about them as something like this. We got this big guy, that's our computer, and it takes everything we want all at once, processes everything, you know, takes out everything we want, you know, as soon as we want it. So I have anything I want to compute, send it, and I get this result immediately. And to a large extent, that's kind of how things work, whenever, at least when we're doing something simple. And one of the ways that this has influenced control is that, you know, having this picture of what a computer does makes us think about controls as something like this, where we have some system, we abstract it all into this block, and we call it the plant, and it's going to have some input and some output. And then what we have is we have this controller that we pick, it's this K. And the thing that kind of comes from this computational framework is that we assume that we can just lump all our signals together, and we can take all those signals at once, do all the data processing that we want to do on them, and then instantaneously spit out some set of signals here. And so we can abstract everything, and it becomes a lot easier to think about, because we don't have to think about all this messiness of, oh, this is coming from here, I've got to process it there, this is coming from here. We just say, oh, I feed it in, I send it to my controller, which is implemented on my computer, and I instantaneously get my result. It's perfect, and it's, yeah. And it's very, yeah, it just works well. And so because using this framework, we designed a really nice theory on how to pick this K when we're given sort of different constraints, optimization criteria that we have. So, you know, we want to optimize some norm between the input and the output or something like that. And a lot of theory has been developed based on this idea that, oh, we can just pick this however we want. But when we go and start looking at how we do things in physiology, you end up coming up with some problems because our brain is not a computer. It's a little bit more like this. Now, this is very much a caricature, but what we have in our brain, it's this, everybody will agree that it is a network. It's this decentralized process. And there are actually, and there are time delays and latencies in between when something gets processed in one part and something gets processed in the other. You don't have this one big thing that computes everything all at once. You've got several regions that compute basically by talking to each other. And so when you look at that and you kind of think about, well, how do I do control on that type of architecture, you get to kind of a different problem. And so this kind of comes to sort of these big picture questions of the idea that sort of control theory was really developed in this close connection with engineering. And a lot of times in physics, you know, people have been trying to take control theory, like I'm one of these people, trying to take control theory and apply them to physiological problems. But when you try to do that, a lot of times you quickly kind of find that, you know, we haven't actually developed all the control theory that you need to describe some of these physiological problems, namely to do control when you can't think about one big controller, but you have to think about a bunch of little guys talking to each other. So that's the type of problem that I'm going to talk about today. So decentralized optimal control and the motor system, because that's what I'm interested in. So I guess I'll get to this by just giving a very, very crude, rough, I'm not a neuroscience person, I'm just a controls person, but a very crude outline of optimal feedback control and its development with respect to the motor system. So in, I guess, you know, maybe in the 90s or so, people started thinking about, well, oh, well, we've got these controllers, how do we pick the gains? And so people said, oh, well, I'll use this standard optimization procedure called the linear quadratic regulator, and I'll use that to find my gains if I want to, say, find the controller for disturbance rejection if you wanted to hold your arm still to perturbation. So that's, you know, so that's good for these sort of small motions, but later on people really wanted to think about, we don't just reject disturbances. Well, things that we like to do is we like to make big motions like reaching and walking and things like that. And so one of the things that was proposed was, well, I'm going to make reaching motions. Well, notice that we have these very stereotypical reaching motions. Whenever I want to make a reach from here to here, I don't, you know, there are many ways I could reach from here to my nose. I could go like this. I could turn around and then go like this. There are lots of silly things you could do. And if you tell anyone in the room, touch your nose, they're going to do this. They're not going to do any of those other things. So one of the early proposals that they had for how we do this procedure is, well, what we do is our brain has this motor plan. There are several proposals. This is not the only one, but this is just kind of in my caricatured development of the field, what I'm going to talk about. So people propose, well, what you would do is you would do some sort of optimization procedure. I'm saying, I want to reach my finger to my nose in a given amount of time, minimizing the energy, and say, minimize the jerk or something like that, you know, some combination of the energy and the jerk, and get there in a specific amount of time. So that seemed like a pretty good idea, that you just do the optimal trajectories. But there are some problems. Oh, yes? So this is a subtle point, actually, that so sometimes they actually do it for these, they end up fixing, it's not the shortest amount of time, because you want to have some sort of balance between the time that you take and, yeah, you're saying get there in 1 second. And yeah, no one expects people to actually do that, but it's easier to do a lot of times it's easier to do the math and try to determine what the appropriate penalty for time is. And that's actually a much more recent thing where people have started thinking about, that's actually in this sophisticated cost functions where they, right, but you are getting to a sophisticated point. Because the idea is that we also have a very stereotypical time in which we would make this motion, and that boils down to, if you want to think about it in this optimization framework, how you're penalizing the time to get there. Because say, if you just wanted to minimize energy, you would take this really slow motion, and stuff like that. And so, exactly. Yeah. So there's this interplay between the cost functions that, at least in the early approaches, they didn't do. They just said, I want to get there in a second. How do I do it? And so then, but one of the problems that kind of arose from taking that point of view is, you design this trajectory, and they say, well, what happens if I'm taking this motion and somebody smacks my elbow? What you don't do is say, oh, I want to get back to that trajectory. Somebody smacked my elbow, let me go back to that trajectory and then follow it. What you do is you say, boop, oh, wherever I am, I just adjust. And that is fundamentally different from pre-planning your trajectory, saying, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to follow that. And the fundamental difference comes in what you do to reject your disturbances. And so then that comes to a different procedure where, instead of pre-planning the trajectory ahead of time, what you do is you pre-plan a feedback policy. And the idea was, you know, I guess in the last 10 years or so, people have been sort of amassing evidence that we're doing something like that, that we actually have these feedback control policies that are in some ways optimizing some sort of task-dependent, some sort of task-specific function. Say, we're minimizing the error between my state and the desired state plus some term that penalizes the amount of time that we take to get there. And so this is an idea that's been taken on. I don't understand the literature completely, so that's life, but it just seemed like, oh, that's interesting that they're thinking about these problems. And some of the things that have happened, people have sort of been proposing what different brain regions are involved in computing the different parts, what's involved in computing the cost function, what's involved in computing sort of the actual feedback terms and that sort of thing. And then nowadays, people are thinking about a lot of the cost functions that we use are chosen more for mathematical simplicity and not so much for biological realism, because in general, this optimal feedback control is really hard to do, and it's actually really hard to actually solve for controllers. So it's not until recently that people said, well, you know, these cost functions that we use and the cost functions that I'm going to present, the things that we're optimizing are really not that biologically relevant. We just like them as they're easy. And so people started doing more relevant functions. And in the more recent work, people have started to really to recognize that our brain doesn't look like this. We can't design it like this. It's more like this. So we need to take into account some extra structure in the controller. So people have done some hierarchical work where they actually break the controller up into different pieces. But in general, as is typical, most of the work is discussing this centralized processing. What is really not very well understood is how these optimization processes could get done whenever you have distributed processing. And in my opinion, one of the big reasons that's holding it back is it's simply not known how to do the optimization when you have distributed processing. Forget about the brain, it's just not known how to do it. So, but as I alluded to, everybody pretty much knows that we don't have a centralized processor. Our brain is, and it's a lot more complex than this, but it's this hierarchical structure with all these different pieces all contributing something. And each one here, there's some sort of choice to be made in how it does the processing, and it turns out that's not just one thing you're choosing a bunch of different things. And when you're choosing a bunch of different things, the problem can get hard. And that kind of gets to the heart of this problem of decentralized control. And I'm not going to talk about this particular problem, but I'm going to talk about this sort of caricature problem for the sake of discussion. So say we wanted to to focus the talk about the actual technical details. Say we wanted to coordinate our hands, and we had an architecture that looked something like this. So we have a hand, two hands, and then we have spinal circuits up here, and we have a brain up here. And all I'm going to impose is that whenever you send a signal across here or a signal across here, there's a delay. So there's a delay to send a signal up, a delay to send a signal down, likewise delay up, delay down. So there's two steps to get to the brain, and a total of four steps to get a signal from here to a signal over here. And so we're going to assume that our controller has these constraints, that it just has these basic delay constraints. When you abstract this into block diagrams, it's going to look something like this. We have the system that we want to control, and then we have, say, a spinal two different little spinal circuits, and a brain circuit. And then these things each represent delays. So this problem that we want to look at is to say, all right, if we're going to assume or believe that we're solving some sort of optimal feedback control policy, but we have to do it with hardware that is constrained in some way, what's the optimal way to do that? And so this is just a simple case study in how you might want to do that. And so in this case, because you've got all these delays between each thing, you have three things you want to pick, and they can't share information instantaneously. This guy has information about from here before this guy does, and vice versa. And for a long time, this was seen as a difficult problem, but it turns out in special cases, if you make some constraints here, you can actually solve these types of optimal control problems. So I'll just get to a little bit of a history of these decentralized control problems. So in the 1960s, it was discovered that these problems where you had multiple controllers could be difficult. And then later on they found that you could actually get conditions that the problem would be easy, and they found some explicit constructors in controllers. And more recently, people have shown that they're convex and that sometimes you can solve them by a convex optimization. But it hasn't been until the last few years that people could actually do what we do in classical control, which is say, this is what I have this cost function I want to minimize. This is the optimal controller. It's really been only in the last 2-3 years that people could actually say, for specific classes of these decentralized problems, if I have the problem, this is the controller, this is how much, this is the cost that you get. So it's been a recent development. And so my thinking was I could kind of take this idea take these more recent results that they had in getting control structures and say, well, how does this apply to neural control systems where you really do want to impose some constraints on the controller because we know they're there, we just don't think about them because it's hard to do. So before I get to that, I'd like to talk about this very classical example because it relates to a problem that, unfortunately, Jonathan and Partha weren't here, but it relates to a problem they were discussing last week, which is, and this really gets to the heart of why these decentralized problems are difficult. So this is an example from the 60s, and what it is you're taking, these things are all scalars here, and what you'd be doing is you'd be taking in this sensory data, and you're choosing these functions, these f and g's. So this would be sort of like your filter, and this would be, you could think about this as, say, your filter, or your controller, or your encoder, decoder, however you want to think about it. But you take in this sensory data, and then based on that data, you choose a function, you choose a number u1, but that u1 gets obscured by some noise, and so then it sends this value y, and then this g, which is just a function of y, has to be chosen with this u2, such that you minimize this quadratic cost function. Now this looks pretty simple, because we just have, these are just numbers here, but they're random variables, and we're just choosing these two functions. But it turns out that this is like a fiendishly difficult problem, and this was posed in 1968, and it's still not known what the optimal control strategy is for this. Because the problem is these are random variables, so it just gets difficult. This problem is non-convex. Its solution is provably non-linear. No one knows what the optimal solution is. You can kind of bound it up and down, but the fundamental difficulty is that a choice was made here when you have this f. This f is making a decision based on the value of x. But then the downstream people don't know what choice it was that you made. So they say, because I'm trying to send what I chose, but this noise obscures it. And because of that, it just, what happens is there becomes this incentive to say, for this u1 to sort of send data to sort of overpower this noise to say, oh, this is what I'm sending. And because of that, you get these weird nonlinear interactions that end up making the control problem really difficult. But not long after this this example was found, yes? This, oh, yes. So people originally thought that if you had a problem where all the dynamics were linear, so they're really, the only dynamics here are u1 plus v, and that's just a linear function. And they thought that if you had all your dynamics are linear, and you had a quadratic cost function, and all the noise was Gaussian, then they just assumed that the optimal controller had to be linear. And so, but then this problem was just like one step or something like that. They show like, so it turns out that if you don't have these dynamics where past decisions affect past actions affect future actions, then these things are linear. It's just because of that whole causality effect that crops up.
What was clever about this example, even in retrospect, is that it gets in time even though it's a completely static problem. So it's a static problem, but it captures a temporal issue that comes up in these temporal controls. So it was a very clever comment.
Yeah. It's because you're introducing noise.
Also, you got this weird cost function, right? You want to approximate x.
Yeah.
But then u2 has to approximate u1. So if you want to make the second one small, you make u1 huge. But then you make the first one better. So it's a trade-off. And then the trade-off really gets mucked up. And this even trivial little problem is still unsolved.
Yep. And people are actively working on it, too. It's not just like
personally,
they forgot about
it's not
it.
Relevant. Good news is, it's probably not relevant.
Yeah, or at least only to a small extent. Yeah, and so, yes? It is, the structure is relevant, and actually, so Partha and Jonathan actually wrote down this problem that was basically this. It was very similar to this, but the thing is there are important differences, and for a lot of times what you can do in the types of problems that we solve is you end up doing, this is related to actually what Minter presented. I didn't see your talk, but what you would do is whenever you have something like this, you would end up getting some sort of coding scheme, which could be this sort of predictive coding scheme, and then you send the predictive code, and then you decode it. You send a code here, you decode over here, and a lot of times you can do a pretty good job. We can't necessarily get optimal things like that, but you can do good enough for control a lot of times.
But this is a stupid cost function, because normally you care about u2 being post x1, and you don't care about what goes on in the middle. And so this is saying, oh no, that intermediate value really, and so this is a contrived cost function that makes the problem intractable. And that's often a case where the intractability is due to the contrivance perhaps more than the real nature. But still, it's a gorgeous counterexample. It's so simple, yet it produces a completely intractable problem.
Yeah. So shortly after this example was made, people realized, well, the real problem here is that this G doesn't have direct access to this U1. And if it did, then the problem becomes a lot easier. And it turns out that that's a technical condition in decentralized control that's called partial nestedness. And what it's actually really closely related to in us is why you can't tickle yourself. So the idea is that if you go and you try to tickle yourself, what happens when I go do this, my brain sends a signal to whatever is processing that sensory data and says, no, it's you tickling. You don't have to respond. It's just you. But if somebody else goes and does it, you don't know what's going on. And you can actually test how this works by, they do these experiments where you move a robot joystick and the robot joystick tickles you, and then they introduce a delay. And so then, as you get more and more delay, you actually start feeling the tickle more. But it's because you stop being able to predict what the motion is. Whenever there's low latency, you know what's going to happen. So your brain just says, don't respond to this. That's the whole idea because you basically have two different pieces that are choosing control. One thing that's choosing a control over here. One thing that's choosing how you control this part of your arm. And whenever that one that's moving this arm doesn't know what this arm is doing, then it would think, oh, something bad is happening over here. Let me respond to it. And this is related to this what's called the reafferent principle, which basically says, when I make a motion, my brain sends signals to the other part of my body to tell the sensory processing regions, this is what you can expect based on what I did. And that's what fails here, is you don't know what, you know, it forces you not to know what to expect based on what U1 is because of this noise term and the way the cost function is set up. And it turns out when you have systems that obey this property that says that if I have this sort of downstream decision that needs to get made, but I know what all my kind of previous relevant decisions are, then the problems actually become, they have optimal controllers, and the problems become a lot easier. And it turns out that, you know, pretty much all animals that have complex nervous systems that can act quickly, like fruit flies and us and everything, have these sort of reafferents that make the control problems a lot easier. Basically, this is kind of related also what Tony was saying a lot of times, that you end up having the structure so that signals get sent around to avoid these conflicts, basically, so that one part of your brain knows what your other part of the brain did so that they can work together. And that's what makes these problems easy. So going back to this system, this is the problem that I'm really interested in. In order to make this easy, I need to actually make some constraints on what this plant is, this system is here. And then once I make those constraints, then I can actually solve this problem and make it satisfy this partial nesting procedure. But I don't know how much of the actual controller I should talk about, but the rough way of solving, but I'll, you know, the natural flow of this was to say that I take this system and I can rewrite it like this. These end up being sort of equivalent systems. I can always take a system that looks like this and write it like this and vice versa. And the thing that makes it, this problem actually becomes a lot easier than that problem, because what I'm doing is I'm lumping all these delays up in the front, and then it just ends up being mathematically easier. But to get a flavor and an intuition for how this controller actually works, I'm not going to solve this problem. I'm not going to present what this problem looks like. I'm just going to do this simpler problem where I'm taking two measurements, and they have access to different information because this guy has access to no delay on the first measurement, but one time step of delay on the second measurement. But this one has access to one time step delay on the first measurement and no delay on the second measurement. And even that kind of simple constraint on the controller introduces this decentralized problem, and it turns out these nice hierarchical structures arise because of this simple constraint. So this is the control problem that I talked about. So I have these linear dynamics, and these are Gaussian noises. And that's, if anybody has questions about these parts, just feel free to stop me and ask. This is a standard type of problem in control theory. But the big difference is that I have two different inputs. This is the key here. I have two different inputs that I'm choosing, and they have access to different amounts of information. This one has no delay on the first one. This is MATLAB notation, so it has access to the whole previous sequence. And then this has, so it has access to the whole previous sequence of this first state, but only access to delayed values of the second one. This has access to delayed of the first one and the whole sequence of the second one. And so with that little modification, this becomes a slightly less trivial problem. So this is just for comparison. These two things are sort of problems that are known how to solve. It's known how to solve them using classical methods. And then this is the problem really of interest, where you have this non-classical constraint on the information that's available to you. And the real non-classical thing is just that they have access to different amounts of information. It wouldn't matter so much it's not as big of a deal what constraints you put on what they have access to, as long as they have access to the same information, modulo some, recall assumptions. But yeah, so this is the problem that you're trying to solve. And so simple example we've been trying to think about during this time here about what are better examples to demonstrate this, but this is just something that I kind of came up with a while ago, where what you have is you have two different subsystems that can only communicate with a delay. You're trying to stabilize this pendulum, but so sort of when we stabilize a pendulum, we don't just stand still. We actually walk around when we do it. And then the idea is that there's a kind of fast loop up here with the arm and the pendulum, and there's a delay between the pendulum and your legs, or I'm abstracting this to a cart just because it's easier to solve things for a cart that you can just push backwards and forwards instead of legs, because they're complex. And what it looks like here is, what happened with the delay problem, it's already kind of went off the screen. But you can see that the decentralized is doing almost as well as the centralized controller. These little bars say how far it's gotten out. And so the real issue is that the main control problem is that that you want to have this fast loop at the pendulum. And so if you do the delayed thing where you said, oh, I'm going to wait till I have access to it. So if you actually had these delays in the structure, but you chose your controller such that you said, okay, I'm not going to act on the information, all the information I have. I'm going to wait till I have all the information that I could get, and then I'm going to act on it. You would get this thing where you've just waited too long and the pendulum fell over. And so, but as long as you have this, the main feedback loop is between the pendulum and the arm, so you get almost as good of behavior, but a slight deterioration because you don't have optimal coordination. Yes? Yes? Yes.
Okay. Now, suppose I make my delay minus one half, right? Mm-hmm. I want the delay part to be a smaller delay than the single point delay probably depends on.
Yep.
In that instance, can you still get, a better control in the third case, or better than you still hopeless?
I chose it to be hopeless. Yeah. If you decrease that delay, you could probably end up, there's going to be some point where you would end up getting it better with if you had smaller delay but centralized. Yes. Yeah. Right. I just cooked this up so that if you,
But a way to think about this is the delay is easy to do, but your performance sucks. The centralized is impossible to do. You can't implement it because you're having no delays at all.
Right.
And it's easy to solve for the optimal controller in order to the rate.
Right.
Yeah, it's just not, so it's just not there. Yeah.
The whole point, Andy's big result is he can solve the middle one just as well.
Okay.
And he's kind of cooked it up so that it has, I mean, he's chosen a problem which is almost as good as a centralized, but is implementable. However, I think the claim is that maybe that's how our nervous system has evolved, to implement number two. It can't do one. It can't do one because it can't be implemented. It can't do three because it's dead if it does three. So it's evolved to do two. And that's a very, obviously, very much of a cartoon. But it's very consistent with Paul's pictures, very consistent with Scott's pictures, very consistent with the physiology kind of that we know. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah, which these guys, oh, see these gammas? Oh yeah, so I chose them. Yeah, just to say that this is any arbitrary measurable function. So you're optimizing over the set of, yeah. And so this is any function you want. So, but I'm just writing there to say, oh, you choose this, you choose a function, one function at each time, you know, two functions at each time, really. So U1, U2. Yeah, exactly. So this is to say that at each time I choose I choose U1, like this U1 is based on, you know, a function and the actual time. And then as you let time go to infinity, it ends up becoming this, it ends up not depending on time anymore. But yeah, so. Yes. Yeah. So. Exactly. So what this is doing is it's penalizing you for the state getting too big, and this is penalizing you for using too much energy. And then I'm just doing an average so that, you know, on average I'm not too big, and on average I'm not doing too much. I'm not using too much effort. So you just know that Q would be positive semi-definite, R would be positive definite, and then there's a few technical conditions to make sure that, like, you don't have states flying off to infinity that you can't see. And so, yeah. And but other than that, not much. Yeah, this is classical stuff. So these two things, in these two settings, you can solve this problem. Like this, it's been known how to solve this for about 50 years or so. And then. Yeah, it's bounded from below. It's convex, and you can just end up doing these like a quadratic program for it. And yeah, so. That's the idea. And it's just that with this one, with a few modifications, you can end up solving it like you solve these two things. So, yeah. And then, so that was the movie. Yep. And then, yeah, I don't know how much time I have. I don't know if I should actually get into, like, you know, the flavor of what these things look like, because that might be a little bit, might be a little dense. So
it's really beautiful or really ugly, and it completely depends on your point of
view. It depends on your perspective, but I think on average it's going to look really ugly to this room. So I'll get to what the controller decomposition really looks like, and I think that can be more appreciated. So what this term is this is the best guess of, so X is the state of the system. So it describes everything we would need to know in the centralized case. And this x hat is the best guess of the state based on the information that's common to both of the people. So say I'm having these choosing U1 and U2. And so there's person 1 choosing U1, person 2 choosing U2. This is the best guess of what x is given the information that's common to both of them. And then this...
Just
one delay back. So they both have access to one delay back of everything. So they would have access to... this. So the common information is actually this, because you can look at it there. That's what they both have. And so then this is the best guess. I skipped it. Yeah. There we are. Yeah. So this is the best guess based on the common information, and this actually is the optimal controller in the. In the case where you had both of them delayed. And what these two things are they're just correction terms. So basically, if you lock that third thing at the bottom, if you just lock this off, this is what you would be applying. And these are correction terms where this zeta 1 is based on information that's available to the first player but not available to the second. This is information that's available to the second player but not the first. And these are just sort of correction terms, and you can kind of lop either of them off, and it still becomes, and it's still stable and all that kind of thing. But, yeah, so it's a, you end up doing a similar derivation to get this. You just have to do a few tricks up front, and then that's what it looks like. And this idea actually generalizes pretty well. So, yeah. Exactly. So this is the predicting ahead. And this is saying, okay, basically what this is the predicting ahead, and this is saying, this is what I know minus the predicting ahead. And so in this, and so that's the idea. So it would be that part would be the predicting ahead part. Yeah. And then these parts are, you know, these little individual actions that can be taken. But it turns out that, so this kind of gives rise to this hierarchical structure where at the top you do the best predict ahead based on common information, and then lower down you do these correction terms.
That's a conceptual diagram. So one of the interesting questions is how would that conceptual diagram actually going to be implemented, right? Because presumably one of the things we've learned about, I learned about the brain architecture, is you have all these local loops that you can plug through. So you wouldn't actually send stuff up the brain back down again, you'd send it across. So that's one of the, but the nice thing about this framework is it lets you solve all sorts of structures. This is the simplest non-trivial case, so it's a good point problem to illustrate. But let me also say one more time, these kind of problems have been around forever, and I had no hope that there would be pretty solutions like this, that you'd actually be able to solve explicitly for H1, H2, and K, compare the cost, all kinds of, no hope at all. The best hope was to be some god-awful convex optimization problem in different dimensions. So the fact that this is explicit is really amazing. And of course, then once you have that in hand, you can sort of go back and find special cases where people handcrafted these solutions in the past with this general theory. And so Andy did. I mean, this is Andy's thesis, and he deserves great credit for doing that. I had no hope for the Trump's theory, and the fact that it did is really striking. And the fact that it looks superficial, like in the light of evolution, naively, it looks like our nervous system evolves to implement these controllers so that you get these shortcuts that lower the delays so that you can do the decentralized control. You don't have to send everything up to the brain back down again. So that structure, I think, is really pretty. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, that's... Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the optimal way to use it.
Might think that this means that you send it somewhere.
Right.
The problem is you can't actually do that because the way he's got the problem set up, you only get one time delay. Right. So you actually have to send it directly across. Right.
Yeah, but I mean, I've actually solved the problem where you do have the time delays, and it ends up looking like this too.
It's much more general.
This is just for demonstration purposes.
This is just the simplest problem that illustrates
the
theorem.
Yeah. So.
But can you
give me a heuristic at least, a basis of which says you could make prediction about how many self-control systems you would have in the brain? Yeah. So the idea is that you would basically look at how long you would take, how many. I'll draw a picture that will. I have a picture here that will kind of demonstrate that a bit. So if you had all of these guys were making decisions, these would each correspond to the in. If you had like actual, if these were all your, say, your limbs or something like that, this were your head, your arms. If you had six, maybe you were a bug, say. For the sake of argument, then the control structure would have this thing where there's a different function being applied at each of these nodes. And what these numbers correspond to, it corresponds to whose data you're integrating. And so basically what the reason you get 1 and 1, 2 is that in one step, 1 can talk to 2 so that above there, so that instantaneously you have this instantaneously here, you have one applying its own data, but then in the next time step, it has access to say head data and stuff like that. Well, yeah, the key concern. Well, that's the main constraint, is that you have latency in the controller, and then this is the this is how the controller decomposes to get around the latency. Yeah. Yeah.
You see that in their brain, they're actively managing delay by controlling the myelination of exons.
Yes.
For instance, if the electric pitch is very sensitive,
right,
then they have these electro receptors in the electrical line for it.
Yep.
And they're able to detect changes in the electric fields at a very high tempo resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done that by adjusting the projections into their cerebellum.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are exactly identical.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They're really correct for any kind of bias because of this through the structure of the process.
Yeah.
In some cases, it's a different approach to solving this problem.
Yeah, so, right.
It's not, this might look like if you have some sort of functional decomposition of some control.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do you do this problem?
Wait. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I'm giving another example.
Sure.
Right. I'm saying, well, the way that these are not fixed, it looks like it's a little different species.
Yeah.
They manage their latencies between their different controllers in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the same controllers performing similar kinds of operations, but the way they're linked to the periphery and with each other, in particular beginning,
yeah,
is different. And
right.
They manage that by different lengths.
Yeah.
So that means they're not changing the way they couple the control.
Right.
That's the same. It seems to be the same design principle.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, when you say same, you mean same across all species? You know,
across many species.
Right?
Yeah.
They will all have some form of a cerebellum. Our cerebellum is not used as a sensory organ. It's the motor. It's part of the motor system. Yeah. For the electric fish, it's a sensory system. Right? It uses a very different.
They have the same basic regions. They're connected differently. No, you're reorganizing the wiring between them.
Reorganizing the wiring itself.
Yeah. So,
that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Well, that makes total sense.
But,
sure.
Yeah.
But I wonder what we can
do. I think what that means for this is you draw different wires here.
Yeah, but
or you myelinate a wire that needed to be low latency.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wires,
right.
I'm not going to tell you how you ultimately structure your controller.
Right. But it's a little bit different because
you should probably break. But yeah, that's yes. Not right. Yeah, that's
oh,
not right.
Misunderstood.
Yeah,
then
yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so that's the basic idea, and I don't really have much else. But so, yeah. So if anybody wants to talk.
The problem with these pictures and the way we draw them, we don't draw the boxes, they're not physiological.
Right, they're not. So,
yeah, sure. And so we don't, it's not clear how to interpret physiology. Here's what it does look like. Here's a couple facts that's consistent with this story. That organisms invest a lot, for example, the withdrawal response in big, fat, myelinated neurons that go to the spine and right back out. So you're investing a lot to get low latency. That does two things. It makes you act fast, but it also lets you actually design and control. So it has two features. Okay. So, but what needs to be done next? So what's clear is there's all these investments in various trade-offs. Right? So what would be nice to do is look at these nested patterns. Those are abstract logical patterns. And it's not clear what box you put the different pieces in.
Yeah, you can't directly map physiology to this.
There's some subtleties, like great subtleties, in thinking about, suppose you want to implement that lower right-hand thing in the upper left-hand frame. Lots of subtleties.
Let me
play.
Okay, I get
lots
that.
Of subtleties.
No, sure, I get that.
Lots of subtleties.
Yeah. So right. And so what I'm saying for this particular diagram doesn't look like this. But yes, so what I can do is I can take these and I don't know how to in general map back, but in special cases I can map them back to look like to these things.
These are toy problems made up to illustrate the theory.
But I can though in some cases I can take these boxes and map them back to look like this things like this, but I'm not doing that in the talk because they don't naturally map in the simple problem that I showed.
Well, the question would be, what's a really simple distributed neural processing problem that we can start trying to take logical diagrams and start mapping them onto the physical? That's kind of one of the reasons we're here.
Yeah.
So maybe this tremor thing might be, because that's got a lot of weight. But actually, doing an inverted pendulum while standing on a tippy box, that's another one. So you got to learn to balance the box, and that's hard to do. When you initially use a lot of vision, you could not balance a pendulum at the same time. And separately, you learn to balance the pendulum, but you can control how hard that is by how long it is or where you look. And then if you get good enough, this becomes so automatic that it becomes a separate loop, a fast loop, when you get the same platform bounding the claim. That you can learn.
Skunk can do it.
No, it shows. Nobody has been able to even balance a damn pendulum. So, but you can learn to balance a pendulum on the tippy box. So the question is, think about if you know simple systems in which you do have these kinds of structures, we would like to we want to find the equivalent of lipolytic oscillation, right? The equivalent of the really simple example where it's got a lot of hierarchy in it, a lot of different delays, and some coordinated control system like the tippy, or the, even just that problem there. Right?
I like
iMovie. You like iMovie? Yeah.
I vote for iMovie.
Okay, sorry. I bet I was I apologize for butting in so much. It's just that I'm very happy with Andy's with our work on this, so I'm overly enthusiastic.
It's all good. It works for me because you're bringing up a lot of points that I forget to bring. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. exactly. Yeah, that's that. Yeah, that's exactly why you want to design these guys. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's basically trying to figure out the optimal way to integrate the information when you have it.
If you push things in your spine, if you can push them in your spine because you have lower latency, that's why you get more skill at a squirt, because in the spine, you have lower latencies. And then this gives kind of a framework for reasoning systematically about
it.
Exactly. Well, yeah, that's what pushing it down gives you. Yeah.
But so happened in this case, if you didn't push it down, you couldn't do it at all.
Yeah.
That's true of a lot of tasks. If you don't push it in the spine, you simply can't do it at all.
Yeah.
So we're interested in concrete physiology that we can start to try to compare. Yeah. Scott's got lots of examples.
My daughter starts driver's education lessons next week.
Cool. Thanks.